Florida lawmakers are heading to Israel. Are they breaking any laws? And who's paying for the trip? Welcome to Sundial on WLRN. I'm Luis Hernandez. Governor Ron DeSantis leaves for Israel this weekend. His delegation includes lawmakers, business leaders, and lobbyists. What's significant about this trip, and are they breaking the sunshine laws? Plus, you've probably seen electric scooters around Miami and Fort Lauderdale. They've exploded in popularity, but they've raised concerns about safety and traffic. Finally, do you remember the hit show Who's the Boss? The co-creator of that program has long since retired to Key West. He's out with a new musical that tells the story of TV show executives called Primetime. But first, a look at a controversial new program that allows for sheriff departments in Florida to work with ICE agents in detaining undocumented immigrants. All of that today on Sundial. First, the news. Welcome to Sundial on WLRN. I'm Luis Hernandez. A controversial new initiative has expanded to 10 counties across the state of Florida, including Collier and Sarasota County. It's called the Warrant Service Officers Program, or WSO. It allows for certified sheriff's deputies to detain undocumented immigrants. Immigrants can be held in local jails for up to 48 hours. During that time, ICE agents decide whether or not they want to go where the detained immigrants are and pick them up. Pinellas County Sheriff Bob Gualtieri has been a leading voice for the program, and he's argued that WSO helps sheriff's departments, quote, enforce the rule of law and keep communities safe, end quote. Civil rights groups like the ACLU have raised their concerns with how the program works. Joining us now from the studios of WFSU in Tallahassee is Anna Ceballos, reporter for the News Service of Florida. Anna, thanks so much for joining us.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Okay. How does the Warrant Service Officers Program work? How is it supposed to work?
Well, first, the sheriff's office needs to express interest to ICE. And then, there's about 37 counties that have expressed some interest, and 15 of them or 10 of them have been approved as of May. And the way that it works is, you know, they go through about 5 hours of training. The sheriff will pick the correctional officers who will be doing this task. They go for about 5 hours, and then they are certified to detain and to serve the administrative warrant from ICE to keep undocumented immigrants who are already within the confines of the jail.
Are they working
for up to 24?
Are they working for ICE?
So it's a cooperative agreement. I mean, it depends on who you ask for, right? That question could be, you know, some can certainly see it that way, but it's at the local expense. They just get the training from ICE.
All right. As I mentioned, Pinellas County Sheriff Bob Gualtieri spearheading this program. What's his argument for it?
His argument is that it's going to be an easier program for the state to be able to cooperate better with federal immigration authorities, because this program stems from a larger program, the 287G program, that is way more expensive, requires correctional officers to go to South Carolina for a 4-week training at the expense of local governments. And this one is, you know, just 5 hours. ICE come to you in a way. And, you know, it's a fast and easy way of doing it. So it will help ICE expand
and this
the cooperation with local government.
And this is part of the concern that we've heard from civil rights groups like the ACLU about the program, not just the ease of it, but also that ICE is using local officers.
Right. The ACLU argues that, you know, it's a way for ICE to, they called it a sham, I believe it was the quote. And they said that it's, you know, using local law enforcement officers to use their own money to do their job. And they claim that the administrative warrants that they're being certified to serve and honor are unreliable, and they're just that, administrative warrants, not a judge order to detain an immigrant.
So the legislature already passed this past session a bill banning sanctuary cities in Florida. So what's the significance of this program once the law goes into effect?
Well, you know, it's funny that you mentioned that because I was talking for the story. I talked to Polk County Sheriff Grady Judd, and I asked him, like, how is this, you know, were you influenced by the governor? Is this bill going to impact anything, you know, that you're doing? And he said, no. Like, I mean, we've been working on this for some time. We've always wanted to do this. You know, we appreciate the passion, but the bill doesn't really do anything. And it's, you know, the bill is forcing local governments to cooperate if there's a detainer issued by ICE. But this program basically certifies local county correctional officers to serve these federal immigration detainers, making it, you know, making sheriffs a little bit more comfortable to be able to do that. And they claim that it's, you know, it's more lawful.
Again, talking with News Service of Florida's Anna Ceballos, 10 counties across Florida have adopted the new Warrant Service Officers Program. It allows for members of sheriff's departments across the state to work with federal ICE agents in cases involving undocumented immigrants. She's joining us from the studios of WFSU in Tallahassee. Anna, how does this expand the relationship that some of these jurisdictions already have with federal immigration officials?
Well, I think it just puts it on paper, right? I mean, we had before early May, May 6th, when this program launched, we had 5 counties that officially had some type of cooperative agreement with federal immigration authorities. And now we're seeing 15, and we are told, and I am told, that there's 37 total that want to participate in this Warrant Service Officer program. So you're definitely seeing, you know, an increase of just more correctional officers who are going to be certified to serve federal immigration detainers. And, you know, they're going to be emboldened to really, they're going to be more comfortable to be able to detain undocumented immigrants for up to 48 hours in jails.
Is the cost completely on the local sheriff's departments, or how much are they getting, you know, for hosting undocumented immigrants and doing this?
Right. Well, I guess they could enter into a reimbursement agreement with ICE. But as of now, the argument that some sheriffs have made is that it's cheaper. It's a cheap way of training because ICE does all the training and all they have to do is labor in terms of, you know, giving their officers the hours, the 5 hours to get the training done. And, you know, other than that, there's really no money associated with, you know, housing them for 48 more hours.
Yeah. But I mentioned 10 counties already interested or already have signed up. But I guess Sheriff Gualtieri said there's up to like 36, 37 counties that are interested.
Right. Yeah. And again, they've expressed, 37 have expressed interest. 10 of them have officially signed with ICE. And the rest of them, I was talking to a spokeswoman with the federal agency, and they said that they can't confirm or comment on any pending requests to participate. So I guess it remains to be seen.
Do we know if any South Florida sheriff's offices have expressed interest?
You know, I don't know, but I know that the Florida Department of Corrections has expressed interest in participating in one of these programs, and they haven't been officially signed on. So that's a big one, too.
We are talking again about the Warrant Service Officer Program, a program that would link sheriff's departments in, again, holding undocumented immigrants in jails for federal ICE agents. Again, it's a training that ICE would do, and 10 different sheriff's offices have already signed up. Many more are interested. We'll obviously keep following this story. Talking with Anna Ceballos, reporter for News Service of Florida. Anna's going to stick around for us here. We're going to take a quick break, come back, switch things up a little bit, because still to come, we're going to talk about Governor Ron DeSantis. He's heading with a large delegation to Israel. We'll get details of that trip coming up next. Welcome back to Sundial on WLRN. I'm Luis Hernandez. Governor Ron DeSantis leaves with a delegation of 100 lawmakers, lobbyists, and business leaders for Israel this weekend. The trip includes a meeting with Israeli President Benjamin Netanyahu and a cabinet meeting on Wednesday, but the details have been scarce. There are still questions about how the trip is being financed, who's going, and why a cabinet meeting is being held more than 6,000 miles from Florida. Anna Ceballos, again, with News Service of Florida, still with us. She's been following this story. Also joining us by phone is Eileen Prusher. She's a professor of journalism at Florida Atlantic University and a freelance journalist for Time magazine, who spent much of her career covering stories in Israel. Eileen Prusher, thank you so much for your time today. I appreciate it.
Good to be with you, Lewis.
Let me start with you. Why would a Florida delegation want to head to Israel in the first place?
Well, there are certainly all kinds of areas of potential common interest, business, environmental, all kinds of sort of friendship initiatives. You know, there are cities in Israel. I believe Boca Raton, for example, where I'm speaking to from now, has a sister city in Israel and Zichron Yaakov. So there are all kinds of reasons. But in addition to that, of course, there is sort of the larger political backdrop. Governor DeSantis, you know, is known to be quite close to President Trump, who has been saying really for almost 2 years now that he would be rolling out some kind of Middle East peace plan. He said that when he gets it, it would be the deal of the century. But as you said in your intro about Governor DeSantis's trip, this peace plan that is going to be rolled out by President Trump or maybe by his advisor and son-in-law, Jared Kushner, the details of that have been pretty sparse so far. And of course, President Trump has made some very controversial moves in the past year plus in Israel, including, for example, recognizing Jerusalem as Israel's capital and actually moving the U.S. embassy from Tel Aviv to Israel, which many presidents spoke about but haven't done. I wouldn't say that there's a widespread agreement on whether or not the timing of that move was wise. As I understand it, Governor DeSantis is going to be visiting at right. that embassy. And so there's a lot of controversy surrounding policy from the White House and certainly what that will mean for Governor DeSantis' trip will be fascinating to see.
Is it common, though, for state governments and delegations this size to make these kind of visits?
I have not heard of state delegations this size going to Israel. What we've certainly seen is congressional delegations. We've seen members of Congress, you know, the House and Senate come on many trips. But I don't recall a time of this happening for Florida or for many other states. You know, we certainly have different, you know, many people of different political stripes in office come on trips to Israel. But as I understand it, this is certainly the first time that is happening for a Florida governor and his whole cabinet going on a trip to Israel while in office.
And that makes this a very historic trip. Anna Ceballos, 100 people at least are going on this trip. Who are some of the key individuals?
Yeah, that's a lot of people, huh? Yeah, well, so, I mean, it includes some top-tier lobbyists from, you know, all the top firms here based in Tallahassee. There's 12 elected officials, 20 people with ties to state agencies, whether it be the assistant to the governor, the communications director for the governor. There's also the cabinet members, 5 legislators, 27 members of the business community.
Are they all going together, by the way? Different people are going at different times.
Oh, yeah, that's the thing. We don't know. Yesterday, you know, they released a list of people, and I've asked questions to the governor's office regarding, well, who's paying for what. I guess Enterprise Florida, which is like a state private marketing firm,
state tourism arm.
No, Enterprise Florida.
Oh, Enterprise Florida. Sorry. Yes.
Right. Sorry. It's not Visit Florida. They're planning the trip. And so they're going to assume some of the cost and planning it. But we don't know how much. And we really don't know. I know, for example, Senator Lauren Book from Broward County is paying on her own. I know Randy Fine, who's a state representative, is also paying on his own. But other than that, I mean, so there's really no information.
Do we know? I mean, look, he's going to meet. They're going to meet, or at least the governor's going to meet with Netanyahu. We know that they're going to have a cabinet meeting, which we'll talk about in a second. And then what? What else do we know about their trip? What else are they doing there?
You know, they're holding a cabinet meeting, and it's going to be the first one. It looks like it's largely ceremonial, even though the governor's office told the Orlando Sentinel that it wouldn't be. I know that they are signing the anti-Semitism bill that was passed this year in session, which is basically, you know, it bans anti-Semitic comments in state campuses, and it kind of cracks down on that. And you know, it's the cabinet meeting agenda has some presentations about the war on terror and water, but there's not much.
Eileen Prescher, let me come back to you. I mean, could this visit be problematic in any, you know, when you think about what we're trying to do nationally, you know, in Israel and in that region? Is there any place or anything that could happen that could possibly be politically controversial for DeSantis or the president?
Absolutely. I think there are a few things. I mean, first of all, of course, there's this sort of rolling out of a so-called peace plan that we've heard about for a while. The problem, as I see it, with recognizing Jerusalem as the capital at this time last year and then moving the embassy there, from the Palestinian point of view, America was supposed to play this role as sort of the fair broker, bringing the two sides to the table, for example, you know, as was done during the Camp David Accords. So you have this situation where there's a lack of trust from the Palestinian side towards the Trump administration. I would have some concerns, and certainly we'll be watching to see, you know, to what extent will Governor DeSantis be seen as just kind of another representative of the Trump administration, being that they were quite close, and his campaign that he ran last year, of course, was pretty much in step with most of President Trump's positions. So if there's anything on that level, I can expect that there might be some pushback from the Palestinian side. We also have heard, of course, and of course this is more of a national issue, but of 5,000 troops being moved to the Middle East. We have a ratcheting up in tensions between the U.S. and Iran. And of course, Israel kind of sits in the middle of that for all kinds of reasons. But as you mentioned, this is going to be a kind of a friendship visit with Israel. And I think, you know, there are some great things in that. But of course, in visiting Netanyahu right now, I can see that Prime Minister Netanyahu is also sitting in a place where he's very glad that the Trump administration has pulled out of the JCPOA, which is an agreement over Iran's nuclear program. Without that plan in place, it's really difficult to see what's going to come next now that we're seeing a rollback of that agreement. So there are some concerns. We've heard about troop movements in the last couple of weeks. There were some people in Congress, like Lindsey Graham, who said, well, what does this exactly mean? What precisely is happening with Iran and the U.S.? And there have been a lot of things that have been kind of flying under the radar for most of us. So I hope that it's an excellent trip for all of the Florida delegation that's going, and that, you know, there wouldn't be any tensions that pop up at this time. But we have that going on. There have been tensions on the Israel-Gaza border. As you know, just a couple of weeks ago, there were a lot of rockets flying from Gaza into Israel, and the Israeli army, you know, responding with airstrikes on Hamas targets in Gaza.
Is that something? It's not something you think that, you know, that having our delegation there, I mean, all of this is happening, their possible role in all of this. Again, I'm talking with Eileen Prescher, professor of journalism at Florida Atlantic University, also a freelance reporter with Time Magazine. She spent a lot of her career reporting on Israel. Also joining us is Anna Ceballos with News Service of Florida. Again, discussing Governor Ron DeSantis' cabinet trip to Israel. It starts this weekend. Now, one of the controversial aspects of this trip we just mentioned a moment ago is, again, they're having a cabinet meeting. All cabinet meetings are open to the public under Florida Sunshine Law. Anna, is it going to be open? Are we going to be able to watch it, listen to it, follow it?
Well, we had some little nuggets that, you know, paint a picture of what's really going on with that, because it's certainly been pretty scrutinized. You know, when they released the agenda for the Florida cabinet meeting, it was kind of interesting. They titled it Meeting of the Cabinet, and then at the bottom there was a little star and says this should not be a cabinet meeting, basically. It said that this is not a collegial body consisting of the governor and the cabinet as a board meeting for an official purpose. And in this Florida constitution, it says that if there's a collegial body of public elected officials even discussing public matters, and if, you know, state official matters, it should be an open record and it should be an open meeting. Florida Channel, which is a state-owned or state-funded television station, they are going to Israel, but we don't really know the details yet. They don't even know the details yet as to how exactly if it will be live, if it will be later on, and just archived.
And I come back to the finance thing. We don't know completely, or is it all through Enterprise Florida, or we don't know completely how everybody's paying for the trip?
We don't know. And it was even hard to, for reporters. I know there's one Florida reporter who will be attending the trip to cover this, and that's Florida Politics. They're going to be attending, but it made it even hard for reporters to even plan an itinerary because the official itinerary was released this morning, and the trip starts Saturday.
Eileen Prusher, besides the federal implications, the international implications, I mean, how do we benefit? How does the state of Florida, look at the people who are on the list, lobbyists, people in higher education, it's a big group of people. What do you think that those conversations could be like, and how does the state of Florida benefit from this trip?
Well, I would say that there are few areas in which there's potential for joint cooperative projects. I know, for example, I teach at FAU, and there's an agreement with the Hebrew University for scientific information sharing, kind of joint research projects. Israel has been a leader, for example, in solar power, which is something, as you know, it has been tried in different parts of Florida. A lot of individuals have solar panels, but there have been some kind of legislative and legal hurdles to wider spread solar power. Also, agriculture, drip aggregation. It's kind of become this almost cliche that Israel made the desert bloom, but it really does. There are places that are sort of bone dry where they're growing tomatoes that are, as beautiful as, anything you'd get in a gourmet marketplace. So I'm thinking that from the business end of it, agriculture, solar power, high tech are three areas where there'll be a lot of kind of attempts at cementing some joint projects that some of the business people, academic people can sort of bring home to their different different sectors to sort of increase ties. And that's something that's already probably, as I know, has been ongoing with Florida and with a lot of different states around the country. But of course, it's taking place at a time where there's a lot of sort of brewing controversies in the Middle East, both in Israel and the larger Middle East. And so Governor DeSantis and his delegation are sort of stepping right into the middle of that.
And by the way, just before we finish up here, Eileen, you're heading back to Israel this summer, right?
That's correct. Yes.
What for work or pleasure?
A little bit of both. I run a study abroad program in Israel during the summer, so I bring journalism students there to sort of try their hand at being foreign correspondents, learning about both sides of the conflict. We do some dual narrative tours. We hear from Israelis and Palestinians. And I'll also be doing some reporting as well. One thing that I've reported on a lot, which there's always a little bit of attention around this issue, and I hope it won't flare up while the Florida delegation is there, but it's around the Temple Mount in Jerusalem, which is also the place of the Al-Aqsa Mosque and Dome of the Rock. So you have sort of some of the holiest sites in Islam and the holiest site in Judaism sitting right one up against the other. And that has flared up from time to time, including on certain holidays. So we're heading towards the end of Ramadan and the Jewish holiday of Shavuot, all coming around the same time. And there have been sometimes tensions or even clashes around that. That's a site that religious people in different sectors feel very strongly about. So I'll be doing some reporting on that. And of course, it bears saying that Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu was reelected recently. However, he has not yet formed a government. He needs a coalition government in order to function. There are some indictments hanging over his head. So it would be a lot easier to say, well, this is how things are going to look in Israel in the next 6 months if he already had a government in place. But that is still not in place for all kinds of domestic thorny issues that are preventing him from doing that. So it's going to be a kind of wait and see scene there in the next month or two to see if Netanyahu can actually get it together, have a coalition in place, or they might even throw it to the next in line, who was Benny Gantz, and see if he could form a government instead or have something what they call a unity government. It's never a dull moment over there, and nope. There'll be a lot of issues to cover in the next few months.
Eileen Prusher, professor of journalism at Florida Atlantic University, also a freelance reporter with Time Magazine, does a lot of coverage on Israel, if you haven't already noticed. Also, Anna Ceballos with News Service of Florida joining us, and we've been talking about, again, Governor DeSantis and a delegation of more than 100 people at least are heading to Israel this weekend. We'll keep following that story. Eileen Prusher, Anna Ceballos, thank you so much for your time today.
Thank you.
Thanks for having us.
All right, still to come, electric scooters, they have exploded in popularity. They're in lots of parts here in South Florida, but are they safe? More coming up on Sundial. Welcome back to Sundial on WLRN. I'm Luis Hernandez. Well, in parts of Miami and Fort Lauderdale, you see people zooming around on electric scooters. Some say we are living in a time of micro-mobility. It's a micro-mobility revolution, meaning more bikes and scooters on the streets. There are numerous companies that will rent you one of these scooters and charge you by the minute. Now, some cities have banned them because they consider them a problem. Others are trying to warm up to the devices. Do you use electric scooters to get around? Are they a good source of mobility for you? Maybe you're not a fan. What bothers you most about them? Find us on Facebook or Twitter at WLRN Sundial and let us know. Joining me now is Carlos Navarez. He's the operations manager for Lime, one of the companies that you see their scooters around Miami. Carlos, great to have you, man. Thanks so much.
Thanks for having me.
All right. So why are cities in South Florida such a good place for this business?
Well, I mean, we've got sunny weather, sunny climate all year round, except in the summer when it gets a little wet around here. Flat terrain, which is great, and obviously we've got some very densely populated cities which definitely benefit from having micromobility as an added transportation method.
Now, what are the rules, though, in Miami? Because, as I mentioned, look, not all cities have bought into this yet, but some are trying to warm up, and they try to put restrictions. There are some rules. There have to be a certain number. There can't be too many.
Correct. Yes. So, for example, in Miami here, we started a pilot program at the beginning of April, which let us begin with 50 scooters the first 2 weeks, and then it let us increase that cap to 100 scooters the two following weeks, and then there's a 25% cap increase month over month based on the usage.
What city right now, if you can name one or two, is like where just things are going so well? Like, it works really well. Everybody's open to it. Everybody loves it.
Yeah, absolutely. So take Paris, for example.
Paris.
In Europe. And more locally, you know, our nation's capital, Washington, D.C. These are cities with thousands of scooters, limited regulation, and, you know, everything's going well. And
is that the goal, to get to the point where there is limited regulation and just, hey, as many scooters as possible, it's fine?
Yeah, absolutely. You know, I mean, I think, especially for Lime, you know, our top priority has always been safety. And as long as, you know, we can get the community's buy-in into, you know, respecting an added way of mobility on the road, so that, you know, drivers look out for people on scooters just like they would look out for people on bicycles.
You said something interesting, though. You said buy-in.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you need the buy-in from the community. Yep.
Do you get the sense that people in South Florida are buying in?
We do. I mean, we've definitely seen, both from the rider's perspective and the community perspective, we've seen tremendous amounts of success from the program so far, increased ridership week over week, active users increasing week over week. And then from the community, complaints mostly just come from private properties, and that's, you know, why I have my job, which is to deal with those complaints in order to have my operations staff reach out and, you know, relocate the scooters.
We'll go over complaints here in a second. Let's go over how this works, though.
Mm-hmm.
So basically, it's an app, right? It's an app, and then you're looking for a scooter. So explain it to me.
Absolutely. So you download our app on the App Store, Android or iPhone. It's a free app to download. It'll show you where all our scooters are on a map. You walk to your nearest scooter. You scan the QR code that'll be on the handlebar of the scooter, and basically it's $1 to unlock it and then 15 cents per minute to ride.
And there are, what, four or five other companies right now in Miami doing this?
There are five other operators. Yes.
Okay. All right. So, and by the way, these scooters aren't docked anywhere. It's not like some of these bike companies, share ride bikes that are docked. Scooters, you can just put them anywhere.
Correct. Yes. It's called the dockless concept. And we believe that's one of our greatest strengths, is providing our riders that ability to leave the scooters wherever they need to in order to increase that convenience factor.
So it's a matter of finding them. Like, if I'm looking for one, it's just, where did somebody leave it? But the other thing, too, is this. If that's the idea, the dockless is, I guess, safety or security of your property, which is your scooter. Mm-hmm. And so, I mean, I'm wondering, like, how many are lost? How many are stolen? How many are destroyed?
There is definitely cases where we do have vandalism, but that's where our Lime's supply chain comes in handy. We have our own proprietary supply chain and always be able to meet that demand that we're seeing in Florida. So even though there is some vandalism, there will always be supply on our side to meet the riders' demands.
I mean, look, they talk about vandalism. I didn't realize this. There's an Instagram account called Bird Graveyard. It documents scooter destruction. It's got 80,000 followers. I mean, there are people who just, they want to destroy these things, mm-hmm. or they get a kick out of it.
Absolutely. And, you know, that's really a shame to see people take this new additional way to get around town and vandalize it. It's not a toy. You know, it should be treated with the utmost respect because it is a vehicle and it really does impact people's lives. The people that use it to bridge that last mile gap in order to get from their homes to public transportation stations, and just people that use it on their everyday, day-to-day lives.
I'm talking again with Carlos Navarez. He's the Miami operations manager for the electric scooter company Lime. The city recently launched a pilot program allowing for electric scooters in District 2. The electric scooters have already been in place in Fort Lauderdale for a while. And we've been asking listeners, what do you think of these electric scooters? Again, do you like them? Do they help you get around faster? Maybe you don't. Dana Lynn Kleinman from Fort Lauderdale messaged us on Facebook. She says, as a cyclist, my hope is that they help the cause of adding more bike lanes in South Florida. They don't belong on the sidewalks or the streets, so a dedicated bike scooter lane seems like the best option. If I'm not mistaken, this is the rule in other cities. Again, you can find us on Facebook or Twitter. Let us know your thoughts about the electric scooters. This is something the state was looking into, right? Is just allowing these scooters into bike lanes.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. Right.
So, I mean, because, look, I've seen these scooters on the roads, on the sidewalks. I mean, ideally, what do you think? Or does the company care what the law is going to be about where they're allowed or not allowed?
Yes, absolutely. Absolutely. So, when scooters operate pretty much on roadways and bike paths instead of the sidewalks, it provides a better experience for pedestrians that are walking at slower speeds on congested sidewalks, right? So as mobility evolves, ideally, you know, the traffic infrastructure of the cities will evolve. And, you know, Lime always takes that proactive partnership with the local communities and governments in order to try to improve those infrastructures.
You said you deal with the complaints, right?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. What do you hear typically?
Typically, private properties, just big condominium complexes where people ride the scooters in and don't leave them in an orderly fashion. And it's just mostly retrievals, which we have a 24/7 ops team on the road, just willing and able to go help out in any way they can.
What about, let's see, I'm thinking about some of the folks I know who ride these. Mm-hmm. Battery life sometimes not good.
Well, I mean, it's due to the high usage. You know, the battery doesn't just deplete on its own. The batteries are depleting because people are using them. And again, that comes into the whole supply. You know, we've got a local warehouse staffed by a local team of Miamians. And they're driving around the city, replacing those dead batteries with new scooters.
How often do you hear from pedestrians or cyclists who will complain about, I've heard from pedestrians who are like, these things are racing up and down sidewalks and knocking me over. What do you hear about that?
So I actually haven't heard a lot of complaints in that regard, which makes me think that everything is going smoothly. I mean, I see it with my own eyes, and I believe everything is going smoothly.
You ride these?
Of course.
Okay. Tell me about your experience. This is Miami. Mm-hmm. Tell me about your experience riding around here.
Well, I mean, the first thing I do, you know, I want everybody to start riding defensively. You know, Miami is a car culture city, so people drive rather aggressively here. So we always have to make sure to, you know, either wear a helmet or wear bright clothing when you're riding these things. Always follow traffic laws. Go with traffic, not against it. And, you know, just look both ways before crossing the street.
There's something interesting, too, that you just pointed out is the safety aspect of this. Is there a liability for the company if something happens to me if I'm on your scooter?
So we are actually the global leader in terms of liability insurance. We cover up to $1 million per scooter.
Where do you see this industry in the next 2, 3, 5 years in South Florida? I want to know from you, Carlos, what do you envision? Do you think we're all going to be on scooters at some point?
I think so. I mean, it really is the way to the future. You know, it's a eco-friendly, affordable way to get around. It really bridges the gaps between a lot of transportation deserts. It makes moving around easier for people, and that's really what's at the core of Lime's mission, is to improve cities by letting people move differently through them.
If you could make one thing better, though, what would it be?
In what sense?
In any way. Just what do you think right now? Because anything could always get better, but what could be better?
In terms of the micromobility industry as a whole?
I guess so.
Less regulations, maybe just like having more cities come to the table more eager to try this out instead of running into like these massive roadblocks. You know, we are putting together a solution or providing a solution to a city. It's not like we're trying to disrupt the city. We're trying to help the city out.
I'm seeing them more and more. They are around. It is the micromobility revolution. Is that the way we're going? Again, been talking with Carlos Navarez, again, operations manager for the scooter company Lime here in Miami. City of Miami recently launched its pilot program allowing for these scooters in one district, checking to see if this is something that you might see widespread in many other places. And again, find us on Facebook or Twitter. Let us know your thoughts. What do you think of these scooters? Do you think this is a good idea? And if not, do you use them? But if not, what do you think we should do? Carlos, man, it's been a pleasure. Thank you so much.
Thank you so much.
Ride safe. Ride safe. I don't have to tell you. Still to come, a former Hollywood producer behind shows like Who's the Boss, has a musical coming out in Key West. Well, I'll learn about it more coming up next. Welcome back to Sundial on WLRN. I'm Luis Hernandez. I got a smile on my face. You remember that show? I love that show. Growing up, that was one of my favorites. You know, for so many of us, so much of what we learned about life, at least I'll say this for me, it was from television shows. I mean, let's see. In the 70s, I grew up with Welcome Back, Kotter, Good Times, Happy Days. In the 80s, it was Family Ties, Different Strokes, Night Court, and, of course, Who's the Boss? Well, the idea of the primetime show is the backdrop of a new musical in Key West. It's called Prime Time, and the person behind it is American television producer and writer Blake Hunter. He's the guy who co-created Who's the Boss, and he's living in Key West now all the time. Hunter joins us from the studios of Key West along with the director of the show and his partner, Murphy Davis. Gentlemen, it's such a pleasure. Thank you so much for joining me today.
Hey, Louis, it's great to be with you, and we're actually husbands. We're not partners anymore, believe it or not.
Congratulations, and thank you for correcting me on that. Thank you.
You're so welcome. It's so easy these days now.
It is.
We're husbands.
Well, okay, that's a whole other show.
Sorry.
We'll bring that back at some point. I wanted to ask you guys about this, because it's interesting thinking about the era of sitcoms in the 70s and 80s. And I'm wondering, what was so unique? Blake, what was so unique about that era?
Blake, what do you think? What was unique about that era?
I was intrigued by the Mary Tyler Moore Show. And from then on, sitcoms were it for me. She represented something really nice. A woman on her own, didn't care if she got a boyfriend or not. And then All in the Family was the same thing. You said things that you wouldn't have said on Father Knows Best, you know? So
right.
I just love the milieu.
One of the things, Louis, that is a part of the primetime musical is the fact that, you know, you referenced it, but those of us that grew up in the 70s and saw the changes then, this is partly about that time in our entertainment and cultural history where kind of the Norman Lear juggernaut pushed the variety show, which had been a part of the lexicon for 40 years almost with Ed Sullivan starting on radio. And then so it just kind of this was a moment in time. And I remember my social studies teacher when I was in eighth grade saying, "Your assignment for the next 4 weeks is to watch All in the Family, and we're going to discuss it every day." And we did, and it actually changed a perception for an eighth grader.
Wow.
You know, so it's kind of amazing that that was what kind of the world that Blake came into with WKRP at first.
Okay, there's another one of my a great show,
great
WKRP
show
in Cincinnati.
Yes.
So here's the show that you guys have, Primetime. And it centers around a television executive, Diana Cherry. And again, as you said, it takes place in that era, the 60s, the 70s, when so much is changing. And I was thinking about Mary Tyler Moore. I thought, wait a minute, is that what this is? It's an era where you start to see women now start to move up in the workforce and take positions of power. But tell me what this show is about, this musical, Primetime, what it's about, really.
Well, in our case, the woman is the boss. She runs the show, and that's a little unusual back in those days. So she was a groundbreaker. And what is it about?
Well, that's what happens when you work a long time on a musical. What are we talking about here? No, it's really about, it's about following a woman in a time when, again, this is the time of the ERA movement. I mean, look at what we're doing with Roe versus Wade these days. We're talking almost a half a century ago, and we're re-looking at the same things that were going on at this time. So a big part of the show is this idea of a woman who's at the top of her game, who's basically now confronted with not only major changes in the industry that she works in, but also changes within the relationships that she's created that helped her become a part of that industry, which is her husband, Jerry Cherry, who's the star of this big variety show.
Yeah.
And it's about people being confronted with changes that they're not expecting and how we all do that in whatever workplace we're in.
I wanted to know first where the idea came from. I mean, I get the sense that, I mean, Blake, for you, this is all the years you spent working in television and all these different shows.
My workplace, yeah.
Yeah, and you're giving us that behind the scenes. But when did the idea to do this musical come from, and how long you've been working on it?
Oh, my. 7 years, and my writing partner in L.A. was also from sitcom. He had worked on the Mary Tyler Moore Show and a bunch of others, and we both were intrigued by... Well, actually, what goes on behind the scenes is oftentimes more interesting than what we put on
yeah,
the air.
It definitely is.
Yeah. So that's how it started. We thought, this is too good to miss, you know?
And Murphy, I wanted to know about, you know, as you try to recreate, because it's always interesting when you do anything from a specific period, in recreating the look, the sound. Mm-hmm. I also wonder, too, in the language, because, I mean, look, we still have a lot of sexism today. But back then, as you said, the world was changing, and everybody kind of took a while to change.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Well, Jerry Cherry, the husband, I think, embodies somebody that is caught, a male that is caught in that moment of change and in flux. And he's also somebody that basically has a deep respect for what his wife does. But that being said, we're seeing male and female dynamics in it that at what you're alluding to, Lewis, is that, you know, that thing between men and women that was not acknowledged like it is today and was, you know, de rigueur, was just part of the workplace. So that's going on in it as well.
They're struggling with the ratings.
Yeah.
Ratings. Live and die by the ratings. And every day you see what the, or every week you see what the overnights were.
And it's a frightening thing, you know, when you're losing a way of life. That's the really what is your the way that you know how to interpret the life, the way that you know your talent works, and to have that start to disappear, and then say, okay, on to the next, which happens to all of us. This is what I love about Blake and Charlie's musical, is that, like I said, you've got the workplace, but it's really a crucible for what all of us go through in whatever workplace. What you guys go through at WLRN, you're kind of a family, and you're a dysfunctional family, I'm assuming, unless everybody at WLRN is just, you know.
Well,
but Well, that's the thing. I mean, that's life, right? I mean, we all get in work.
Those are the interesting stories.
Exactly.
Okay, well, I'll work on WLRN the musical for some point in the future. I'll get to it. I'll get to it. I'm talking with TV producer Blake Hunter. He co-created the television show Who's the Boss? And along with him, his husband, Key West director Murphy Davis, and they have a new musical that started last night. It's called Primetime, and it shows, as you've been hearing, the ins and outs of the TV production world during the 60s and 70s, and the lead character is a female television executive. Again, it opened last night at the studios of Key West, and it's going to be running for a couple of weeks. We'll have more information on our social media at WLRN Sundial. You know, coming back to this, I wondered, I mean, last night was opening night. Let's go to that. I wondered what the response was from the audience. What did you hear from people?
They loved it.
Well,
we had all our friends
there. Oh, okay. All right. There you go.
I have to admit. But the acid test is tonight when our friends aren't. But they loved it. They were responsive to everything. And it was a joy.
It was. You know, Lewis, we've been working on this together for about the last 4 years. And I was saying to Nan when we were getting ready, somebody said this to me yesterday, it's like a birth. You literally, it's like you have 4 weeks to get something that did not exist except on the page up and out. And, you know, so I was really pleased with the audience response. And basically, it was half friends and half people that I didn't know. So I was very impressed with the response that we got last night. And yet, because when you're working on something, you're still working on it in your head. If you're sitting there watching something that you've been putting a lot of time into 4 years, it's not like I sit back and just kick up my feet and enjoy. I'm going, okay, now there was a moment. Oh, what happened to that moment? Or, you know, whatever that is. But it was a good opening night, that's for darn sure.
Good, responsive audience.
Yeah, yeah.
How is the, you know, because you think about putting together a television show and what goes into that and all of the, I mean, there's so much detail that goes in. But doing a theatrical performance, especially a musical, it's the same. It's a lot of work, but different.
Very different.
Yeah, how did those two?
With sitcom, you've got the same characters, the same set, and the same audience probably every week.
Wow.
Here we're starting from ground zero, and we're building that whole thing.
What was it like putting this together? And again, it's not just a show. It's a musical. So you're creating this whole musical, a playlist. For the show as well. What was that like? I mean, as you said, it took years.
Well, nobody gave us the music. We had to write it ourselves. And
the lyrics.
The lyrics, which I love.
Blake's an extraordinary lyricist as well. It's quite something. And a lot of the folks came out of the show last night saying not only did they love the music because it's very accessible, meaning you're actually, the tunes are sticking in your head, but it's also the lyrics. Blake knows how to tell a story through lyrics, tell an emotional moment through lyrics.
What's your favorite song, if you have one, in this
mine
show?
Mine or Blake's?
Both of you, for this show.
Oh, God. I have three. I have four.
Poor Again. We wrote a song when she is saying, I want to go back to being poor. And she doesn't really want to be poor. She wants to go back to when they were first married, when their relationship was new, and it didn't matter that they lived in a cheap apartment. What mattered was they had each other.
Yeah, the connection.
And I always enjoy giving a thing a negative title and been trying your best to make it positive, and that's what we did with that song.
You sure
and
did.
Murphy, you said three or four, but give me one.
I love the ending of the first act. It's called The Kiss, and it is a moment of revelation for two of the characters, and it's a really spectacular duet, and it brings the house down at the end of the first act. So I always love having a house being brought down.
you can't argue with that. Is the music also inspired by the music of that era?
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah, what's interesting, Lewis, is that part of it is very much in the variety show kind of. It has that sensibility. And then there's also, you know, as you know, in the 70s, we had, you know, Carole King, James Taylor, Carly Simon, Simon and Garfunkel all starting to really come in the early. So there are also these lovely ballads that are, that feel more like that, and they're more personal songs. So it's kind of split between the songs that are showbiz songs for the show and then the personal songs where we learn about the characters and where they are.
Let me finish with this real quickly. I have to ask you both this question. Is you think about the golden age of television, but, you know, compared that to where television is today with streaming and on demand, what do you think about the business now?
Well, Blake,
I don't watch television. Okay, if this is treason, make the most
of it.
Yeah, and the thing is you know, Lewis, we are of that a generation where it's a different world in terms of that. I don't mean that it's a different world in terms of the impact of good work, whether it's good theater,
right,
good television, movies. That is age old. We know when we respond to something and are moved by something. But my God, I don't know how you guys keep up with everything.
Well,
Blake and I, it's like just using our phones correctly. We've almost divorced over it three
times.
You
know, yeah. Back in my day, it was ABC, CBS, and NBC.
Right. No, listen. I got a lot of people who tell me, have you seen this, or this? Hey, listen, I can't sit down and just binge. I can't do it anyway.
Yeah, how do you do it?
I don't know.
Yeah.
I don't know how they do it.
I know there's a lot of good stuff out there because all my friends are telling me about
there
it.
There is.
But, Lewis, we got to eat. We got to eat.
That's true. That is true. Blake Hunter, again, you know, the producer, creator, and Murphy Davis, the director behind this new musical. It's called Prime Time. It's playing at the studios of Key West through next Saturday. The show is about the behind the scenes of a television program in the 60s and 70s. A lot of fun. Blake, Murphy, I really appreciate your time. Thanks so much.
Thank you so much. Lewis.
And break a leg.
Thanks.
All right, that's our sundial for Thursday, May 23rd. I'm Lewis Hernandez. Have a great Friday, a great weekend. Happy holidays. Play it safe, please. And we'll talk to you again next week.